Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk. I am your host, Ryan Van Winkle. Fantastic to be back here with you to talk about books. What else would we be here for? We're talking about reading them, loving them, getting involved with them, making them, and we have some very exciting people on the podcast today to talk about those subjects. We have Karen Kukkonen, and she's going to talk about her books, which kind of delve into the subject of how we read graphic novels and comic books. She's an academic out of Oxford University, and she's written a load about this subject. It's a super fascinating conversation about what comic books are about and for. We also have on the podcast Arati Prasad, who's written a book called Like a Virgin. And I'm just going to leave it at that and let that titillate you for a little bit until we get to her segment. But first, Joanne Harris. You might know her as the author of the popular novel Chocolat. And we sat down and had a fantastic conversation about her brand new book. Here she is, Joanne Harris.
Hi, I'm Joanne Harris. The title of my book is Peaches for Monsieur le Curé. It is the third in a series of books I've written about Viane Rocher, the heroine of Chocolat. I'm reluctant to call it a trilogy because it could end up being more than three books. And I'm reluctant to consider it a sequel because it now happens 8 years after the events of Chocolat. And Viane, who I thought was actually nicely settled in Paris with her man, with her two daughters, building a life for herself, she's a little like me in some ways in that she has a problem with connections and with the past. And she has a problem with being told what to do. And she has told herself that she will never go back to the village of Chocolat, Lansquenet-sur-Tarn. And since she told herself this, in the same way that since I told myself this, we have both been longing to go back. It takes some doing bringing her back to that place because she has bad memories of it and she's slightly afraid of what she'll find there. And so was I, in some ways. I didn't want to see it too badly changed. And when I finally got her and got myself back, I realised that the year was now 2010. Europe, politics, and other kinds of religious politics have also entered the arena. And so I set it that year at the beginning of Ramadan, which to me is a nicely circular progression from Chocolat, which was set at the beginning of Lent, another period of fasting and feasting. But this time Lansquenet has a whole new immigrant population of North African Muslims who present their own challenge in a kind of quiet way because we've got two very traditional little communities, a Catholic right-wing French southwestern community and a North African Muslim community, going through the troubles that existed in 2010, which were all about the veil and banning the veil, and several countries had already done that, and France seemed about to do that, which is why I set the book just about then. And the little bit that I'm going to read, not a very long bit, is from the beginning of the book. And this is where Viane is still in Paris. And it's just a hint of things to come. It began in the galley the other day. I was making truffles. In this heat, only truffles are safe. Anything else runs the risk of damage, either from refrigeration or from the heat that gets into everything. Temper the couverture on the slab. Heat it gently on the hob. Add spices. Vanilla and cardamom. Wait. For just the right moment, transmuting simple cookery into an act of domestic magic. What more could I have wanted? Well, maybe a breeze. The tiniest breeze. No more than a kiss in the nape of my neck, where my hair, pinned up in a messy knot, was already stinging with summer sweat. The tiniest of breezes. What? What possible harm could that do? And so I called the wind. Just a little. A warm and playful little wind that makes cats skittish and races the clouds. V'là le bon vent, v'là le joli vent, v'là le bon Jean, mamie m'appelle. It really wasn't very much. Just that little gust of wind and a glamour, like a smile in the air, bringing with it a distant scent of pollen and spices and gingerbread. All I really wanted was to comb the clouds from the summer sky, to bring the scent of other places to my corner of the world. V'là le bon vent, v'là le joli vent. And all around the left bank, the sweet wrappers flew like butterflies, and the playful wind tugged at the skirts of a woman crossing the Pont des Arts, a Muslim woman in the niqab face veil, of which there are so many these days. And I caught a glimpse of colours from underneath the long black veil, and just for a moment I thought I saw a shimmy in the scorching air, and the shadows of the wind-blown trees scribbled crazy abstract designs across the dusty water. V'là le bon vent, v'là le joli vent. The woman gazed down from the bridge at me. I couldn't see her face, just the eyes, coal accented under the niqab. For a moment I saw her watching me, and wondered if I knew her somehow. I raised a hand and waved to her. Between us, the Seine, and the rising scent of chocolate from the valley's open window. Try me. Taste me. For a moment I thought she was going to wave back. The dark eyes dropped. She turned away. And then she was gone across the bridge. A faceless woman, dressed in black, into the wind of Ramadan.
I really love how sensory it is. And I was wondering, actually, how hard is it to go back and to put yourself in this place, in these characters, again? Is it something that comes quite naturally, or do you have to really create a mood for yourself as a writer to put yourself back in the place and in the feelings of this? And of course, you're doing loads of things. You're doing other books and other stories, and to switch register again, to go back to the one from Chocolat and Lollipop Shoes, how does that feel, and how hard is it for you?
We learn to love fictional places and fictional characters with a particular affection. We like them to be immune to the rules that life imposes on real people. Now, as a reader, I understand this perfectly. As a writer, it's impossible to please that part of myself. People grow old, people die, people get sick, people get changed by life. When I wrote The Lollipop Shoes, I got letters from people going, what's happened to Vian? Why has she changed? Why have you changed her? And I had to explain that actually I hadn't changed her. Life had changed her, and I hoped that, you know, she would find herself again, and she did. But, you know, she had been going through a bad patch, and people felt I was responsible. I really wasn't. Life does that to people, and if you want to create characters that people will believe in, then they can't be immune to life.
What is it like to have an audience that's so engaged with the work that they feel comfortable enough to write to you and say, hey, what what did you do?
I'm very lucky to have such a large and varied audience. It's great that I have this relationship with them, and they can talk to me on the net and on Twitter and on my website. But respectfully, I do ignore them when I'm writing. I have to. I can only please one person at a time. That person has to be me. Otherwise, the rest of it will fall through. And so afterwards, people, well, you know, it's a question of caveat lector. People have to take what they're given, because I take what I'm given. It's not like I have control over the rules that govern life and story. Those things are very intimately intertwined, and sometimes bad things happen to good people, and I kind of wish they hadn't done, but the story made it that way.
How important is it for you to be accessible and to explain this to people when you're getting these letters and you're responding to them on your website or on Twitter, like, hey, this is the reason? Is that an important part of the story and part of the process for you to kind of articulate why you've made the choices you've made or why the characters have made those choices? Is that an interesting part of the process for you?
It does interest me, because I think the relationship between reader and writer has evolved enormously and massively with the rise of the internet. I think it's both a good and a bad thing. I think it's a good thing, because you can have a dialogue. You can explain what you meant by something. But a lot of the time, I like people to come away with something that they have figured out rather than something that I've told them to think. It's not. I was a teacher for a long time. For 15 years, I told people what to do, basically. I no longer have to do that. They can work things out for themselves, and I would much rather ask questions than give answers. And so I feel very uncomfortable when someone comes to me and says, what am I expected to take away from this story? Because really, you take away as much as you bring to a story. It is much more enriching if you come with that kind of attitude than if you come expecting to be fed information or issues or ideas.
Yeah, and speaking of issues, I guess real issue behind it, whether or not France would ban the wearing of veils.
I mean, I had been thinking about writing a book about the veil for some time. I wasn't sure where I was going to set it. And then suddenly these real events started to catch up on my story. I'd written so many books already about issues of identity and false identity and what we choose to reveal about ourselves and what we choose to hide and how that affects other people's perceptions of us. And I thought, well, the veil is the next thing. It's a prime example of how you can be at the same time invisible and extremely conspicuous. And I was interested in why women, particularly women in the region that I live in Yorkshire, who are young women and who are several generations away from their country of origin, are choosing to begin to wear the veil when their mothers didn't and their grandmothers didn't. And I thought, what is it? Is it a political statement? Is it an attempt to return to a culture that they feel is disappearing? What is it? So it's not a polemic about whether or not I believe that the veil ought to be banned. It's really what we say about ourselves, how we express ourselves through different media. And it's also a story about two communities that seem very different on the surface, but actually have an awful lot of things in common.
Thanks, Joanne. Everybody get a copy of her latest book. And also, if you want to find out more about her, she's got a fantastic website that she updates all the time, joanne-harris.co.uk. And of course, you're going to want to follow her on Twitter just to find out about those stories that she's telling using that medium. You can follow her at Joanne Chocolat. And of course, you're going to want to follow us on Twitter if you haven't already, at ScottishBKTrust. And don't forget, you can join in our conversations on Facebook simply by clicking the like button or check out our website. There's loads of great things on there. More audio and more book-related material. Read up on lists and gather stories till your heart's content on ScottishBookTrust.com. Our next guest is Arati Prasad, and her book is called Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex. In this book, she kind of goes through the myths exploring virgin births, and it's a super interesting history, and it's a super interesting type of science that she's getting involved with.
My name's Arati Prasad, and my book is called Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex. A lot of the chapters in the book have stories that you can't make up, I mean, and they're true. And if you look in the archives, you find a phenomenal load of nonsense, but also really fascinating insights into what the extremes of biology is capable of. The original subtitle of the book was Exploring the Frontiers of Conception. Nobody liked that, but really it is about the frontiers, about the history and the future of the idea of reproduction being something different from it is now. In the 1950s, so 1955, there was a scientist called Dr. Helen Spurway, and she was a geneticist, and she was studying reproduction in guppies. She did an experiment where she got guppies just as they were born and separated the males and the females, and she found that even though she'd done that, the females kept reproducing, though they hadn't been with males and they hadn't mated, and they weren't reproductively mature when she separated them. And she took that as conclusive proof that you don't always need males to procreate. She thought, though, there were three reasons why it could be happening. The first is that somehow the female baby fish were exposed to sperm while they were still in their mother's womb. The second idea was that they could be hermaphrodites, like snails and earthworms, which means they have both male and female reproductive organs inside of them, and therefore they could fertilize themselves. Because earthworms don't meet a whole lot of other earthworms. They take the opportunity as they can.
Do they really? There's no mixers for earthworms?
That's the thing. There's so many strategies in nature. Some animals can reproduce if they meet a mate, but if they don't, they can go ahead and have babies anyway. So the third idea she had as to why the guppies were reproducing on their own is this biological concept called parthenogenesis, from parthen or virgin, from the Greek, like the Parthenon, is the goddess Athena was supposed to have been a virgin, which means that sex was not necessary for them to reproduce. So she gave a talk at UCL, and I think in response to a question, she speculated that this could also, maybe it happens in humans too. I mean, there was no good reason as to why not, although it did sound pretty far-fetched. But if it did happen, it would be really rare. Otherwise, you'd see it happening quite a lot in places of female segregation, like prisons, female prisons or female hospitals. This was in the 1950s, and this was a time when, if you were a single mother, your child was taken away from you and put out to adoption within the first few weeks of life. Also, for reasons of social stigma, maybe women wouldn't talk about this, even if they did. She suggested there are ways of testing whether this could be true if they had people come forward. They'd have to be genetically identical. A child born of a virgin mother with no input from a father wouldn't have any genes that weren't coming from her mother. And that talk would have stayed in UCL, except it came to the attention of a journalist called Audrey Whiting, and it made the front page of the tabloid that she worked on called the Sunday Pictorial, which was the forerunner of the Mirror. And she single-handedly, in fact, in her obituary, it makes note of the fact that she single-handedly doubled the distribution of the newspaper that day with this story. And the headline was, "Doctors now say does not always take a man to make a baby." Yeah. But what it also did was announce a call for women to come forward. So it was like citizen science. It was like, come forward if you think this has happened to you. And 19 women came forward. 11 were immediately disqualified because they thought that being a virgin mother meant that they had intact hymens, or their hymen hadn't ruptured. Another woman was disqualified because she and her daughter didn't have the same eye color, and the rest were disqualified because they didn't have the same blood type. Only one mother and daughter pair was left. And this was a German woman called Emmy Marie Jones. And Jones isn't a German name, but she married a Welshman after the war and moved to the UK. This was 1955. In 1944, she had come down with a bout of rheumatism, and she was confined to an all-women's hospital. And she left. She was discharged. But 3 months later, she went back to her doctor because she wasn't feeling so well. And she wanted a tonic, a pick-me-up. The doctor said, "Emmy Marie, I'm not surprised you're feeling run down. You are, after all, pregnant." And she said, in her description of the events later, she said, "I smiled in disbelief because I knew the facts of life and I knew that I had not been with a man." And he just said, "You'll soon see that I'm right." And sure enough, 9 months later, she crawled out of the cellars in Hanover where she'd been sheltering, because Hanover had been leveled by the Allies, and she'd raised Monica there for the first 2 years of her life. So when Emmy Marie in the UK now reads the story 11 years later, she has 11-year-old daughter Monica, she grabs it as a chance to try and finally prove what she'd always suspected. So she writes in, and a very charming letter, kind of broken English, where she says in the final lines, "I should tell you that I'm a German, in case you want nothing to do with a German." Uh-huh. "But I'm married to a Welshman, and I've been in England for the past several years." So they subjected her to a battery of tests. And these tests were printed in the medical journal, The Lancet. And they did several tests. So they had to have the same blood type. They have to be have the same status in what's called a secretor test. And that's kind of like your blood type. And then they ran their blood serum proteins to see if they were all the same size, and they also were. And there was another test, which is quite an odd test, of the ability to taste a chemical. This chemical, you either don't taste it at all, or it tastes absolutely horrible. Dr. Helen Spurway said the most conclusive test that she could do if they agreed to it would be a skin grafting test. So I don't know how they got ethical approval in those days to take a patch of skin off a child and her mother. But they did agree to it. And they said that if they could prove that she wasn't a virgin mother, nobody would have heard another word about it. So they took them to a secret location. Monica, the daughter, agreed to it only if she would be given comic books. And she was given comic books. So she went off. And they had the skin grafting test. They technically failed that test. So they couldn't conclusively say that there was a father involved, but taken all together, they'd passed all of the other tests and sort of passed this one, except not completely. So the results were published in The Lancet saying, we can't disprove this. The Sunday Pictorial in the journalist Audrey Whiting published a more triumphant headline in the paper saying they can't prove that any man was involved in the creation of Monica. You know, my question is, we've known since the 17th century that aphids could reproduce without males, and you know, they knew fish could, they knew reptiles could. In the 1950s, there was this kind of mood of progression of science and technology, and they were very experimental. There was a Scottish scientist called Richard Beattie in Edinburgh, had this idea that he would create farms, or that farms could be created where there were only female animals, so sows and cows and ewes. Why, he said, should we spend all these resources on feeding big males just for the sake of a little sperm? The US Department of Agriculture went one better and actually did it. They developed a line of turkeys that reproduced purely parthenogenetically. They were called white belt spill turkeys. Wow. This is probably the most virgin birth thing about your Christmas dinner. You know, it was something that was in the zeitgeist. People were doing it. People were talking about it. Was she mad, Helen Spurway, to put this out there? But I don't think she was crazy, because there was no reason at the time to suppose that we couldn't.
So what happens now? And I'm particularly interested in the fact that the newspaper headlines of, you know, oh, man are obsolete. But then, you know, in reading some of the reactions to your book, you know, there's that question as well. Like, oh, well, what does this mean? This would be a terrible thing. But it's not, is it?
It could be a great benefit to men as well. It's not just about women. But if you look at what's happening on the cutting edge of technology today, say in stem cell science, or say in work towards creating an artificial womb, stem cells are cells which have the potential to become pretty much any cell in the body. A liver cell will divide to become another liver cell, a skin cell will become another skin cell. But a stem cell, given the right signals, given the right environment, can become pretty much anything. And that's why they're able to influence it. This has a potential to generate families that we've never previously seen. Mm. I mean, I think it's quite funny, all the debate around gay marriage and the church not wanting to do it. And I think a lot of that's predicated on the Bible saying, you know, go forth and multiply and that kind of thing, that marriages should be fruitful and gay couples can't be fruitful, but they might be able to be one day. And then what do? Because a male couple who can, one of them donate sperm and the other create an egg from his body and use an artificial womb. A Japanese group of scientists were able to create the first mammal in history that had two mothers and no father. And they did that by using two eggs. They tricked one egg into thinking it was a sperm. So if you can create an animal with two mothers, if you have the potential for creating eggs and sperm from a man, that's something that's never before been able to happen in history. And something that suits the way our progressive democratic society is moving. Yeah. Do you know, evolution's about adaptation, and this is not biological evolution because we don't have the time, but using technology, we might be able to adapt our biology to suit our lifestyle.
Arati Prasad, everybody. Her book, again, Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex. Make sure to get your copy today. Lastly, we're gonna close the podcast with this conversation about comic books with Karen Kukkonen. And if you don't know a whole lot about graphic novels, or maybe you've been a little bit hesitant to kind of dive into them, you might want to get your pen out. There's going to be some titles flying at you throughout this conversation, which I'm pretty sure you're going to want to check out. We talk about some of my favorite graphic novels that I've read and some of the ones that she's read that sound really interesting. Here we go into the world of comic literature.
Karen Kukkonen. My current research project is on the rise of the novel in the 18th century, where, like the graphic novel today, was, you know, finding its form, was sort of developing its narrative strategies, its conventions. All the things that we think typical of the novel today were developed at the time. The example with the idea of polyphony, multiple voices at play in a novel, which works very well in a graphic novel as well. Of course, considering novels as literary artifacts that tell you a story, that engage you in a particular way through heroes and villains and the way plots develop and fold back onto themselves and then are resolved, all of these things, of course, also happen in the graphic novel just as much.
I mean, can you have an imagistic simile, metaphor? I mean, you can have a... Yes?
So, of course, you can have metaphor on a visual level. If you think of metaphor as a combination of two conceptual domains. If you say he's lion-hearted or something, like Richard Lionheart, which is a metaphor, of course, he is as brave as a lion. You've got the man and you've got the lion, and these two conceptual domains are matched onto each other. You could, of course, do that quite easily in a comic as well, where you've got one image of a man and then the next image of a lion, where you can have them interposed, put on top of each other.
Or you just have Lion Man, the
for
superhero.
Example. Yes, yes. The most obvious example. Yes.
Because, I mean, I guess going back to the idea of the novel, novel was pulp, right? I mean, that was entertainment to some degree early on in its history.
Probably was a good thing that Watchmen was one of the first comics I read. And I think the preconception that about what comics are and what it can do is dramatically changing at the moment.
Why do you think that is? Is it coming from the media? Is it coming from institutions like the Academy? I mean, is it coming from just the grassroots level of people reading different things and accessing them differently, less superheroes, that kind of stuff?
I think it's many different factors coming together. We now have sort of a critical mass of high quality comics, the Watchmans and the Sandmans and the Mouse and all of that. And there is the idea that comics can do that. You also have comics being available in different formats than they used to be. You can now go to a bookshop and buy a comic in a trade paperback format. You don't have to go to a specialist shop to buy a comic book. They're very easily accessible. You don't have to
go into that Simpsons-like room with the guy who's going to treat you like an idiot.
Yes. And then, of course, comics are beginning to make their way past cultural gatekeepers. So you read reviews of the latest Batman in The Guardian. You get comics nominated for, you know, Pulitzer Prizes and things like that. So I think there is a lot happening at the moment.
Can you tell me a little bit about how postmodernism influenced comic books, because I know that's one of the topics you've written and talked about.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the shorthand term for the, you know, the cultural condition we've lived in since 1965 or something. So, and of course that influenced comics. You've got counterculture comics, you've got underground comics, got highly reflexive superhero comics where superheroes, for example, would set out to meet their author to tell them that they want their story changed, things like that. It has been that way of thinking has been part and parcel, of course, of comics narratives just as much as any other kind of narrative. So, for example, you would now find superhero comics like, say, Warren Ellis's Planetary, which not only take a very self-reflexive stance on the superhero, but they would also engage in reconstructing a new history of the genre. So there's not only the deconstruction going on, the taking things apart and looking at them from an ironic distance, which is one of the things typical of postmodernism, but you would also then have a movement towards building up a new image.
It must get very expensive. They're not cheap.
No, they're not cheap. Regular books are much cheaper. That's very true. On the other hand, then regular books don't have beautiful pictures and colored prints and all of that.
Actually, I used to get my comics from the library.
Yeah, public libraries actually are brilliant places. I mean, if you want to figure out what, you know, you've heard about this new comic, you're not quite sure if you're willing to lay down the £10-15 it's going to set you back to buy it. You go to the library, you have a look at it, you make up your mind. I think public libraries are really great for comics.
Yeah, that's how I got through all of Fables. Did you ever read Fables?
Yeah.
It's right up there with Angela Carter, right? I mean, it's a retelling of the fairy tale myths.
Yeah. Fables is taking this stance of sort of, yeah, looking at it from a new angle. Yeah, at the same time, Fables is also rather conservative. For example, the idea of romance, that the happy ending for Snow White and the Big Bad Wolf is a picture book wedding. So it takes the postmodern aspect, but it turns it into something else. Thinking of comics in terms of an artifact that engages our minds and our bodies. It's a way, I think, of taking a step back and not thinking of them in terms of images and words, but in terms of how they communicate living in a postmodern world.
What would some examples be? Like, what would it be a good example of a graphic novel that communicates what living in a postmodern world feels like?
Warren Ellis and J.H. Williams' Desolation Jones, where you have an MI6 agent who lives in a bad future, Los Angeles, and they're constantly moving around the city. So the way in which you move across the page, in which you are directed to move through the pages, creates an impression of the kinds of transience.
In the terms of just panel structure and how it looks on the page, is it just the portraits of, because I've not read this book, I want to.
Yeah,
but is it like just pictures of airports and hotels kind of spaces, or has he done have they done something interesting and new in terms of the way? I mean, the medium is the message, right? So like the way that those panels are set up are going to affect it. I imagine it's not all splash pages and things or double page spreads. No. It's got to be. They must be doing something different, and I wonder what that is.
For example, you would have a page where you have a big red line goes all the way across, and which has different functions in the different panels. So it might be a sideline on the road, it might be a reflection on someone's glasses, or it might be a route on a map. So there's this big red line that gives you the reading path, but it has different functions in the individual panels. And of course, because you've got such a clear, bright reading path, you move through the page very quickly. All of this also gets discussed in the dialogue. So while you moving your eyes through the page, and you also get actually a very sophisticated discussion of supermodernism.
And it would be really hard to do that in a film. I mean, you can't do it in a film quite that way, obviously.
In a film, you're mostly in one frame, whereas with a comic, you can have several frames and you can arrange them in different ways and connect them up. You can have multiple possible paths of moving around a page, which is very hard to do in the film. There are some films which work with split screens and things like that, like Ang Lee's Hulk adaptation, for example. That does try to recreate having multiple panels on the same page through split screen and things like that. But you see, it's really difficult to do it well, or well, Ang Lee, I think, is a good director, but it's really difficult to have comparable effects in film. Yeah,
it's almost untranslatable. That was infuriating watching that film.
Actually, before we leave, would you name five highly recommended graphic novels?
Well, I mentioned Warren Ellis's Planetary, which the series has been completed quite recently. There is Promethea by Alan Moore and J.H. Williams, which I think is exceptional. There's Craig Thompson's Blankets, which gives you a new take, I'd say, on autobiographical comics, which, of course, we're familiar with from Spiegelman's Maus or Bechdel's Fun Home. Blankets is very interesting in comparison with them. We talked about Fables. I think that would be on my list, at least the beginning of the run of the series. And, well, then there's 100 Bullets by Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso. And that's quite interesting because it features the premise that there is a man going around with a suitcase with 100 untraceable bullets, and he offers you a chance to set things right in life. And then it's all about whether people will, you know, take the gun and what they'll do with it.
It's such a good idea.
Great premise, yeah.
Thanks a lot, Karen. I could talk about comics with her all day. I absolutely love the medium. If any of our listeners get a chance, go back and download our podcast with Joe Sacco. He's a fascinating comics journalist. It's a really, really interesting type of work he does, and you're going to want to listen to that too. So thanks again to Karen for sitting down with us, and thanks to all our guests we had on the podcast today. Karen Kukkonen, of course, Arati Prasad, and of course, the lovely Joanne Harris. And thanks especially to you, our listener. It's such a pleasure to be with you. Pull those earbuds out, sit down, make yourself a nice cup of tea, and get yourself into a book. It'll feel great. And we'll be back in your ears again very, very soon. Until then, goodbye for now.